Welcome back to Money and Politics in Delaware. We bring him back a couple of times a year. Welcome back, Dave Boomershine.
Thank you, Dave.
Your formal title is Senior Actuary, and it's Boomershine Consulting Group, LLC, which is your company and your headquartered, what is it, Ellicott City in Maryland?
There you go, Ellicott City in Maryland.
All right, and you've done national speaking in the world of actuary. And let's see, you are still the actuary at Newcastle County, Delaware. You are you choose not to make any comments about any clients.
Yep.
I served on that board for 10 years, and through that, you and I were friends and remain friends. Is that fair so far?
You are correct.
All right, you ready to go?
Yep.
You are a headline these days after years of being the gals and guys with the green eye shades in the back, but you're a headline. Talk about the background. I don't even know what I'm asking, but the background to this public sector funding, all the noise about Chicago and Detroit. Just talk to us about the background about public sector funding.
Okay, it's finally getting attention, and you just keep reading about in the papers here and there. But what they're really concerned about is, are the public sector pension plans or government pension plans being funded appropriately? There's a couple of different ways of looking at that, and there's lots of different perspectives and audiences that we can talk about later. But what they're really looking at is, how well funded are the pension plans? What's the funding ratio, which is how much of the actuarial liabilities are actually covered by current assets? And are the governments, the plan sponsors, actually contributing the annual costs that are necessary to fund those pensions for future years?
All right. And let's add one more paragraph to that primer. At the end of the day, for those municipal retirees, the money is either going to come from their own contribution, from the municipality's contribution, from the investment returns, or, drum roll please, from the taxpayer. Is that fair?
That is absolutely fair. That's the total picture.
And the big debate, I would argue, right now is, and we'll beat it to death as far as the myriad of inputs to it, but what is, in your opinion, the correct funding ratio?
Okay. Again, funding ratio, assets divided by actuarial liabilities. In the industry, what's considered to be a healthy plan in the public sector is an 80% or higher funding ratio. What we find is that there's been some national surveys, and in the public sector, the average funding ratio, funding percent, has been running about 72% last year. Assets did well last year. We think the update is that's going to be an average of more like 73 or 74%, which means that there are plans who are well-funded, over 80%, over the average of 72 or 74%, but then there's a lot of plans in that average that are well below the 72% average that we have right now. And it's those plans that are poorly funded, like 60%, some even less than 50%. They're the concern. They're the ones that are getting headlines.
And the concern, healthy, rather than talk less filling, tastes great. this 80% figure, what does that mean? That the taxpayers isn't going to be whacked or possibly whacked or benefits could get cut? I mean, why is 80 the key? What's healthy mean in your word choice?
Okay. What we mean by that healthy is that when we do an actuarial evaluation, we actually look out into the future and then figure out what the current liability for those plan for those benefits that are going to be paid in the future is. So if you're doing this forward-looking, and then you want to compare current assets to those liabilities, you want to be at least at 80%. The end result being that you will have some consistent, continuous contribution level that will appropriately fund those benefits to be paid in the future when people retire.
All right. With that said, you were here a couple months ago, and we talked about, at that time, the city of Wilmington, Delaware had been mentioned in a Pew study, I guess it is. And at that time, from that, it received publication or press out there. I believe the article was Coming Pension Meltdown, the 10 Most Troubled City Systems. And at the end of the day, it's your story to tell. What did the Pew Foundation and or the article I referenced say?
It actually pulled out City of Wilmington. as one of those top 10 poorly funded plans. They were number six on the list from the Pew study. And what if I took a closer look at it and actually looked at the financial statements for the city and saw that they are using a reasonable discount rate of about 7.5%, but the Pew study said that their funding ratio, that's the topic we were talking about, was at 59%. Well, the most recent financial statement that I looked at said that they're really, for the six or seven pension plans that they have, they're more funded around 50% at that 7.5% discount rate, which is a key. But then I took another look, and there's another item on there, retiree medical, the other post-employment benefits, OPEB benefits for retiree medical plans. And this is a relatively new requirement that they should be funded, or guideline that they should be funded. And that OPEB liabilities were actually still using the old 8%, which is out of date now. The trend has been moving down to 7.5, now getting closer to 7%. But at the 8% discount rate, there's something inappropriate there. There's a no-no, because the city is not fully funding their annual costs. And the Government Accounting Standards Board has guidelines about that that says if you are fully funding your annual costs, then you can use a high discount rate, like the 7.5% or 8%. If you're not, and the city is only funding about a quarter of their annual costs, you should be using a much lower discount rate, more around the neighborhood of 5%. So the accounting guidelines are calling for something different than what they actually include in, than what the city's including in their financial statements. And their funding ratio for that OPEB plan, they're saying it's around 12%. If you use a lower discount rate and then lower the discount rate, the higher the actuarial liabilities, the higher the annual costs, that funding ratio is more around 8%.
Wow. By the way, on the article referenced the 10 most troubled cities, I think there was somebody that pointed out that the Pew study had, like, if I remember correctly, it was only the largest city or the capital, so being of each state. So the article was a tad harsh overall. For instance, if I remember right, Scranton and Pittsburgh, for instance, had ratios even lower than the city of Wilmington, but did not make that list. Is that fair too?
Yeah, I agree with that. What they actually included, what the Pew study included, was cities with populations over 500,000 or the largest city in each state. So they actually only surveyed 61 cities across the country.
Touche. The huge headline news is in your world is Detroit. For a first-time listener or somebody that hasn't read a newspaper in the last 6 months, why is Detroit in the news?
Well, yeah, this is one of the hottest topics in public sector pensions. Detroit has actually gone into bankruptcy. There's a few other governments that are now going into bankruptcy, but Detroit is the biggest, and it is key in watching what's going to happen in the pension world. They're going to be setting precedents. The real argument here was that Michigan is one of those states that protects pensions in their state constitution. So under state law, the pensions are protected. They can't be reduced. The bankruptcy coordinator that's come in has proposed a plan where they do cut the pensions, even the current pensions for actives and possibly for retirees. And what's and the contradiction here is that state law protects it, but federal law, federal bankruptcy law, does not protect pensions. They're just like any other creditor to the city. So under federal law, it appears that the pensions can be cut, and this will set a precedent for others across the country. It has gone through round one of legal challenge, and the judge has allowed the pension cuts. So now they're going through mediation and counter lawsuits and so on. So it's going to be very interesting. I'm sure it's going to take years to settle out. But it'll be interesting to see what the final conclusion is. Can public sector employee pensions be cut or not?
His name is Dave Boomershine. It's Boomershine Consulting. And when we come back from break, I got to give you a juicy tease here. We're going to do California, Rhode Island. They're right in the news with Detroit these days. In addition to that, we're going to wrestle through a discount rate. Again, his name is Dave Boomershine. Fascinating guy. We're going to take a short break, and we will be right back. Welcome back to Money and Politics in Delaware. One of my favorite guests. I always learn something. His name is Dave Boomershein, Senior Actuary. Boomershein Consulting Group is his company. And we just tackled Detroit, but also under that umbrella is California and Rhode Island. Tell the story, Dave Boomershein.
Interesting stories going on there. And again, all governments are struggling with how to balance their budgets and so on, and pension costs are a big issue. So in California, there's been a number of governments, and I'm going to pick on San Jose as the special story, where they're trying to do something about their budgets. They can't afford it, so they're cutting pensions. CalPERS, the state pension system, which all the municipalities are members of, and is the largest pension fund in the world, has threatened lawsuits to them, to the local governments, if they try and make changes in their plans. San Jose is the special case where the mayor actually went through and did a voter referendum to approve that he could make changes. But CalPERS, again, threatened them. And then he has now proposed and put a group together to put it on a state referendum. But apparently that became too difficult, and he's backed off, and they're dropping the effort. So over on the other side in Rhode Island, the finance director of the state came up with a deal where actually worked with the unions to come up with pension cuts, thought they had it all approved. They approved the legislation. Then there was some fighting going on, and the courts have told the state of Rhode Island, go come to an agreement, some sort of compromise, so that you don't make as drastic the reductions as you made as were formally approved. So you have to go back and change the deal and come to some settlement on, a compromise to make their changes.
Is it as simple as Detroit got spanked or is in the process of getting spanked because it moved from the local yokels to the federal level, and California and Rhode Island haven't? Is that fair or not?
No, that's absolutely fair, because it's the key at Detroit is they've gone into bankruptcy, which kicks it up to federal court.
Plan changes. Talk to us.
Okay, plan changes. This is the crux of the issue, is that there's this, in public sector world, there's this employee contract. And under employee contract, you can't make changes on benefits. And some states, about 8 or 9, actually have it in their constitution. You can't change a pension plan, even on a prospective basis, let alone a retroactive basis. So there's legal protections against pensions that you can't make changes. But then there's been some arguments out there in the states that don't have it in the Constitution is that we have dire financial straits. We cannot maintain the sustainability of this pension plan unless we're able to make changes. So there's a conflict in there. So there's been a number of cases across the country, and I'll just give a quick rundown and stop me at any time. But in Arizona, they tried to change the COLAs for the judges, and that became a no-no. The courts didn't allow that. You can't make changes for judges. But then in New Mexico, they wanted to make changes on the COLAs, the cost of living adjustments for retirees. And in New Mexico, it's considered that employees have property rights, but the COLA change, because it's on a year-to-year basis, is not a property right, and therefore they can change it. South Dakota went along with New Mexico. They can make changes for COLAs. In Colorado, and this is another trend that we're going to see, because this is going to be a legal fight for a decade, maybe even longer, but now we're seeing it going up to the state Supreme Courts, whereas the courts allowed COLA changes in Colorado, now it's in the state Supreme Court. In Washington, COLA was changed under a reservation of rights. In other words, the benefits that were promised, there was a reservation of rights to make changes in the future, and therefore they've taken COLAs away there. Illinois has got a number of changes, but it's in legal action, class action legal process. New Jersey, the same thing. It's all in litigation. And then in Florida was interesting. Florida had a non-contributory plan. Employees did not have to contribute to the pension plan. Florida made a change to require employee contributions, and it went to the state Supreme Court, and they said, yes, this is not an impairment on the employment contract. You can make changes for employee contributions.
Wow. Yeah. Talk, well, let's go relatedly. plan funding perspectives?
Yeah, I mentioned earlier that there's all these different audiences and different perspectives of people that are watching this public sector pension debate go on. Certainly from the government, the local governments, the plan sponsors, they need to balance budgets. So they're trying to reduce costs somewhat. They're fighting with the unions or in the states that have unions because the unions and the employees, of course, want to protect their benefits, whether you can afford them or not. And then you look at it, public sector versus private sector, it's apples and oranges. Private sector is governed by federal law and different accounting rules. They have screwed up that private sector system so that it's more of a short-term focus, whereas if you think of retirement, it's a long-term focus. So actually the public sector plans have a long-term focus and much better handle on that. But then the taxpayers are weighing in because a lot of them are in the private sector, and they're not too keen on paying for benefits for their employees, the government employees, for benefits that they can't have because they're part of the private sector and the federal government has screwed that up. But finally, the last audience, and probably the most important one, is the bond rating agencies, where they're taking a closer, much closer look, now that bankruptcies are showing up, closer look at funding ratios. And another aspect is they want to know, are the governments paying the annual cost to appropriately fund these benefits for the future? And just to give an example, Moody's has came out with a bunch of guidelines and said, we're not going to be using that 7 or 7.5% of value liabilities. We're going to use a much lower one, something that's more closer to fixed income, maybe, and there's a curve and index that they use, and it comes out to more like 5.5%. Well, again, the lower the discount rate, the higher the liabilities, the lower the funding percentages. But then Moody's tacked on at the end of their publication. They said, we're going to do this so we can do an apples-to-apples comparison. But in the end, we think that there's only going to be about 2% of plans or governments that will be potentially revalued for their credit rating. So they made a big deal of doing all these calculations, but in the end, it's only going to affect the really poorly funded plans.
Yeah, and that's my disconnect. We spoke in the first segment about 80% on a funding being ideal and 60% being not ideal, and yet the rating agency hasn't apparently punished huge number of plans that are not 80%. Help me with that apparent disconnect.
What they're really doing is, when they say we only see 2% as being 2% of the plans being candidates for revaluation, they're really saying the plans that are 50, maybe 60%, but certainly 50% or less on the funding ratio grid.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. We're going to run out of time. Discount rates is another hot topic. What is it? Tell us why it's hot.
Again, it's key because the discount rate has the key actuarial assumption. When you're valuing the liabilities and the cost, it has the biggest impact. And it used to be the old standard 8% because that's what they thought that funds were going to earn on a long-term basis. They finally recognized that's unrealistic. The trend has moved down to 7.5%. The national average is still around 7.75%, but clearly moving to 7.5%, and starting to move from 7.5% closer to 7%. So on a long-term basis, you probably should be looking at liabilities using a discount rate of 7 to 7.5%.
And is it fair to say the Bogles out there that founded Vanguard have been screaming for a 4% rate, and the Republicans somehow came up with a 5.5% correlating to some fixed income metric. And then you have the actuaries and the consultants tied to the current 7, 7.5. Is that a fair soundbite?
Well, there's even some in the actuarial world that go along with that riskless interest rate of 3 or 4 or 5%. So there's some in that camp, but for the majority, it's still, what is the fund going to earn, because this is a long-term basis, and we're still seeing, when we talk to the investment consultants and ask what's the long-term, 30-plus years, and we're still hearing between 7 and 7.5% for a diversified portfolio.
With that said, Dave Boomershein, Boomershein Consulting Group, get your pencil handy, here you go, 410-418-5567. We thank him. Looking next week John Stapleford, economist, always brings an audience. Join him and me here for next week's Money and Politics in Delaware.